the spring of 2018, protests erupted across Nicaragua. The government responded to these protests by killing dozens of people and injuring many more. Journalists and activists were forced to flee the country. Over the next 6 months, the violence only got worse.
About 300 have been killed in violent clashes since protests began, including several police officers and many students.
This is a brutal, murderous government.
Four decades after one of the most iconic revolutions of the 20th century, young people in Nicaragua are again risking their lives to protest a violent dictatorship. And the dictator?
Daniel Ortega.
Daniel Ortega.
Daniel Ortega.
Daniel Ortega, asesino! Te culpamos de la muerte de todos mis compañeros el día de hoy en este ataque!
On this final episode of Revolution Revisited, how a country that went through a revolution, a civil war, and a sort of miraculous transition to democracy found itself under the control of a dictator again today. Last episode, we heard how the Contra Wars came to an end and how the Nicaraguan people elected Violeta Chamorro president in 1990. We know now that this moment wouldn't last long. So let's go back to 1990 and see how this whole story got us to today.
Por vuestro honor, respetar la Constitución, las leyes y los derechos del pueblo, y si no, os haga responsable. Muchas gracias.
Not long ago, few Nicaraguans could have imagined this moment. Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega handing over his title as president to 60-year-old Violeta Chamorro, elected with the backing of the United States.
Violeta Chamorro is elected president in an internationally monitored, free election in 1990. And it seems to the world like maybe, finally, Nicaragua's political violence is behind it. Chamorro and her advisors move into the presidential palace, and the Sandinistas move out. Almost immediately, this new administration realizes something. Getting power is one thing. Using it to successfully rebuild a country is quite another.
The challenges in the 90s were big.
Cristiana worked closely with her mother's administration.
First of all, to rebuild a country destroyed because it was economically destroyed. Then you have to reduce an army from 200,000 people to 2,000 people. We also have to transit from a state economy to a free economy.
And once again, the U.S. gets involved. But this won't be anything like last time, with Reagan and the Contra and guerrilla warfare. That's because by the time the Chamorro administration takes power in 1990, the Cold War is over. And the U.S. has big plans to bring Latin American countries back into the Western economy. And many of those countries, including Nicaragua, are eager to get on board with the United States. So the Chamorro administration welcomes the U.S. through the front door this time, along with their friend, the International Monetary Fund. Here's Stephen Kinzer describing this brave new world.
We were then involved in a project in Latin America called the Washington Consensus. We were trying to tell all the Latin American countries, there's now the way out of all your troubles. You have to cut subsidies. You have to rationalize your budgets. Don't have a lot of social benefits. You've got to balance your budgets. You've got to work with the International Monetary Fund. And we imposed this all over Latin America.
Essentially, the U.S. incentivized all these policy changes with the promise of big loans to these countries in Latin America. In the econ and finance world, this is known as structural adjustment.
We told Violeta Chamorro, okay, you got to fire all those people that have been on the payroll that really don't do a lot of work. And then you have to cut the bus subsidies. You have to cut the bread subsidies. Those are all inefficient. They suck money out of the treasury.
The Chamorro administration cuts government spending.
Violeta Chamorro wound up firing hundreds of thousands of people. That was a disaster.
So like 200,000 people lost their jobs overnight. And these were middle class people. So imagine 200,000 people, each worker represents a family of four. You're talking about almost a million people who've become poor overnight.
This in a country of like 4.5 million people.
Right? Like, great, there were elections, but you don't eat with elections, as we say in Nicaragua.
So there was trouble in this new government. Meanwhile, the Sandinista Party is experiencing chaos themselves.
After the election of Violeta Chamorro in 1990, the Sandinista front went into a kind of shock.
Gioconda Belli was still a member of the Sandinista Party at this point.
Some of us thought we had to modernize the party. We had to make it more democratic.
First order business in this new reform removed Daniel Ortega as the party's leader.
We felt he was associated with all this period of war, and the natural thing was to change leadership, you know, and kind of start anew. But he felt, you know, attacked. He felt he was being pushed out, and he reacted by turning against everybody who was criticizing him and turning us into traitors.
Ortega wasn't willing to step down. In fact, he had only one real goal at this time. As Alejandro Bendaña puts it,
getting himself back to office by hook or crook.
For a person like him, there's no other option than power. It's power or death. So the means to get there, I think, are irrelevant, particularly when you look at his background. These are people who were willing to give their whole lives. They sacrifice everything. It's victory or death. And Ortega, unlike many of his Sandinista comrades, was never able to evolve beyond that.
Move number one for Ortega: take down the person with the power he wants. As the Sandinistas try to do things like hold conventions and party congresses, draft platforms, basically, as they try and act like an actual political party in a democracy, Ortega establishes his own movement within the party that is much less interested in this kind of arrangement.
They called it gobernando desde abajo. We will govern from below. And they made sure that they would block streets, call strikes, try to impede any programs from the government that they didn't agree with. They made life very difficult for Violeta Chamorro.
Everyone we've heard from on this podcast eventually leaves the FSLN in this period. Gioconda leaves in 1993, and Luis Carrion leaves in 1995. Alejandro becomes less and less involved in the party, but he doesn't formally leave for a few more years. The last straw for him, though, and for many others, finally comes in the form of a disturbing scandal in 1998.
That's just the worst abuse of power ever. Any person that is capable of doing that ethically and politically should be banished.
Beyond disturbing. Really worse than you can imagine.
Mateo explains how in May 1998, Daniel Ortega's stepdaughter, her name is Zoila Merica, she goes public with appalling news.
She accuses her stepfather not just of, like, molesting her, but really, actually, if you read the report, she accuses him of holding her in a sort of state of sexual bondage, basically, since she was the age of 11.
She alleged that Ortega said it was all part of her, quote, revolutionary duty.
I had thought very bad things about Daniel Ortega, the way he handled himself politically. I didn't like him, but I never thought he had been abusing Soil America.
It's worth noting, this was more than a political scandal for Alejandro. He had in fact been married to Soil America in the 1980s. They were separated by the time this all came out in 1998, but they were still close.
Ortega, for me, for many others, not enough, politically died at that point.
That's because the Sandinista Party, on the whole, reacted to this scandal in a way that made everything worse. Here's what I mean. So Ortega married Zoila Merica's mother, Rosario Murillo, back in 1979. When Zoila Merica goes public with her story, her mother disavows her completely.
She comes out and says she's mentally ill, or under the influence of foreign agents, or both. She backs Ortega. and she throws her daughter under the bus.
It's hard to imagine what would lead someone to do this to their own daughter. Stephen says that maybe some of it was out of a loyalty to the FSLN. But he also has a much more damning interpretation.
Think of the position that she was in. She's thinking to herself, if I support my daughter and say it's true what happened, then Daniel Ortega's finished. He's not going to be back in office, and that means I'm finished. Or say, my daughter is lying. In that case, I am the number one crucial person to Daniel Ortega. He can't live without me because at any moment I can change my mind. Either being a nobody or being the most important person in the country. And the only decision she had to make was, I'm going to throw my daughter over and say that I think she's lying.
From that moment on, it was very clear that if you wanted to denounce Ortega, you could not pretend to remain affiliated with the party. And so it became a serious milestone and a sort of strange victory for Ortega.
Another party, more decent, would have said, gee, Mr. Ortega, you are accused of this. Could you please step aside while an independent investigation takes place? Because we take these allegations very seriously. That did not happen. They just said, no, she's a liar, she's this, she's CIA.
And that began the development of the Sandinista Front that we know today, which has very little to do with that party that was founded back in the 1960s and is essentially a vehicle for maintaining the two-headed dictatorship of Ortega and his companion, Rosario Murillo.
Over the next decade, Ortega would lead the FSLN, the sole focus of becoming Nicaragua's president again. In 1997, Violeta Chamorro's term as president ends. She had brought the country to a second free election, no small feat in Nicaragua. But the country's economy was still struggling and corruption was rampant. The winner of the next presidential election in 1997 is just staggeringly corrupt. And the president after him, who's elected in 2001, spends most of his time cleaning up his predecessor's corrupt mess. In each of those elections, Ortega runs too. And each time Ortega loses, but he recalibrates a little, trying to find a winning coalition. And he takes a surprising turn.
He understood that the Catholic Church was a crucial player in Nicaragua. So he developed, with the help of his wife, a semi, or more than semi, religious speech. He covered himself with the scriptures and he talked about God, the Virgin Mary, the saints, every time that he comes to make a speech.
In 2005, he performs a second wedding ceremony with Murillo to win approval with the Catholic Church. In 2007, there's another election. Ortega runs for president, again as the leader of the Sandinista Party. He gets about 38% of the votes, the most of the five candidates running. And it's just barely enough to avoid a runoff. In other words,
he's back. Re-elected on a slim 37% of the vote.
El resultado preliminar favorece al candidato presidencial del FSLN, Daniel Ortega.
Ortega institutes policies that enrich his family and political supporters. His corrupt maneuvers are actually too numerous to list in full, but here are some highlights.
So number one, Ortega had developed this bizarre plan to sell off pieces of Nicaragua to a Chinese entrepreneur who was going to build this multi-billion dollar canal across Nicaragua. And they began the process of seizing land and pushing people off their traditional homelands. Then came a series of political maneuvers in which Ortega took control of the Supreme Court, the Congress, and the Supreme Electoral Commission, thereby ensuring his total control over the political process. And finally, there were a series of wildfires all throughout the southern Mosquito Indian region along the Costa Rican border. The government didn't do anything.
On top of that, obviously, there were no more free and open elections.
Now that he's back in power, he's not going to make that mistake again.
Ortega appeased any groups with power in the country, be it the Catholic Church or business leaders, so long as they didn't challenge his leadership.
To the economic elite, Ortega said, make yourselves rich, but stay out of politics.
Like another Somoza, exactly.
Myself, I don't feel Sandinista anymore. And that is because the Sandinista name has been completely corrupted, because it's been appropriated by Ortega. And whatever he does to the rest of the people, it's done by Sandinista. So anybody with the Sandinista name or whatever is in sync with his policies and his actions and everything. So I really don't feel a Sandinista in that sense anymore.
For a while, many folks put up with Ortega's political abuses in return for some stability and economic growth in their country. But dissatisfaction was bubbling right under the surface, up until 2018, when it boiled over. That spring, Ortega cut Social Security benefits in Nicaragua. And for many people, these cuts were the last straw.
Daniel Ortega is used to having full authority, but he now has to face more and more people in the streets.
The protests swelling into a broader nationwide revolt against Daniel Ortega's 11-year rule.
These were the largest nonviolent protests in the country's history. Ortega responds brutally. Authorities attacked and fired on civilians in the streets. 30 people were killed. But the protests don't end. In fact, they grow.
Violence in Nicaragua has killed more than 200 people since the political crisis began 2 months ago.
Then counter-protests start in support of Ortega. Occasionally, the two clash.
Daniel Ortega, asesino! Te culpamos de la muerte de todos mis compañeros el día de hoy en este ataque!
The violence escalates throughout the summer of 2018. Armed militias backed by the Ortega regime and its supporters terrorize activists and journalists. Over 300 people died in this period, ultimately, and 80,000 would flee into exile. Almost exactly a year after these protests started, in May 2019, just this past May, former Sandinistas, Contras, government officials, and diplomats came to the Watson Institute at Brown University in Providence to talk about the Sandinista Revolution and its legacy. It was also an anniversary. It had been 40 years since Somoza was overthrown. But to many people, it felt like 1979 all over again. To an outsider like me, this conference was kind of surreal. It was like part academic symposium, part political strategy session, part college reunion. Between sessions, I saw former Ambassador Anthony Quainton walking down the hall with Sergio Ramirez, a reformist who was Daniel Ortega's vice president in the 1980s. Nicaraguan student activists swapped stories with Sandinista activists who were old enough to be their parents. Contra fighters debated with former Sandinistas like Luis and Alejandro. Just passing these people in the lobby of the Watson Institute, you wouldn't know this was actually a reunion of revolutionary fighters, reporters, and lifelong activists that had written the history of their country. Believe it or not, no meeting like this had ever been held before. And lots of folks who came to the conference told us that this type of thing could not happen in Nicaragua today. Such honest and, at times, heated discussions about Nicaragua's history wouldn't be tolerated under Daniel Ortega. Sessions always ran long, and intense conversations and debates spilled out into the halls during every coffee break. But despite all this and all the differences of opinion, there was one common idea that seemed to unify everyone, and that was that Daniel Ortega has got to go. Sitting here in 2019, it's easy to feel cynical about the Sandinista revolution. Like the story ends with an old dictator by a new name. What did all the fighting and death and misery get Nicaragua in the end? Of course, you can't reduce history that way. I asked Mateo at one point.
What do you think? What's your answer to that? Was it worth it?
Look, I think you'd have to be... That's just one way of asking the question. But yeah, I mean, I think it would be perverse to say that the armed conflict was worth it. I mean, 70,000 people died between the fight against Somoza and the civil war. On the other hand, that's very different from asking, you know, would these people do it again? There was no way out but armed revolution in the 70s.
Folks like Alejandro, Luis, Gioconda, and so many others, they shook Nicaragua out of a dictator's grasp in 1979.
A lot of Nicaraguans found a voice in the Sandinista project. So even if the economic outcomes were terrible, even if the regime isn't actually today implementing policies like favorable for poverty reduction, you know, they don't understand what the image of the revolution represents for people who, up through the Somoza dictatorship, were completely invisible.
One thing that gives lots of people hope today, this new generation of activists in Nicaragua, the ones who rose up in April of 2018, they've paid close attention to the history of their country and have learned from many of the Sandinistas' mistakes.
I do sense that the younger group has realized that when you violently overthrow the existing regime, you set in motion a process that you cannot control. It's like releasing a wheel from the top of a hill. You let it go, but you have no control over how it bounces or where it's going to end up.
The protests in 2018 ended tragically and violently, but the movement it started is still growing, both inside and outside the country. And hopefully, these young people will be able to avoid some of the mistakes of the past, including many of the ones we've talked about on this show, and learn what they can from folks who were in not so different a position 40 years ago.
What we have to realize is that these kinds of governments do not last forever. I mean, history is very clear that dictatorships go down eventually. The need for freedom is so strong in the human soul that it's going to overcome all the obstacles. And I don't know exactly how it's going to happen, but I trust that young people are going to find a way. We who have a little bit of experience are here to go along with them.
Revolution Revisited is brought to you by the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. Our show is produced by me, Dan Richards, with production assistance from Alina Coleman. Our editor is Julia DeWitt. John Mazza's our executive producer. Music by the Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Alex LaFerriere, Sarah Baldwin, Catherine Dunkelman, Steve Bloomfield, Mateo Harkin, Stephen Kinzer, and everyone who spoke with us for this show. For more information about the conference this podcast is based on, including photos, lectures, and a short film featuring many of the voices you heard on this podcast, visit watson.brown.edu/Nicaragua. If you liked this podcast, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps others find the show. And make sure to subscribe to Trending Globally if you haven't, to hear more of the stories, voices, and conversations that come out of the Watson Institute. Thanks for listening.